One of the frustrating elements of shopping for any technology is understanding how it is different. What makes one product distinct from another? And I hesitate to use the word better or superior because here in Packet Pushers, we know very well that when you do a product comparison, which product is better corresponds tightly to it depends. What might make a product better in the eyes of one person is no big deal or even a negative feature in the eyes of somebody else. All right, so with load balancers, aka application delivery controllers or ADCs, we definitely have this challenge. At their root, load balancers all do the same thing. They offer a virtual address that load balances traffic to one or more real hosts, and then maybe it does some sort of fancy packet manipulation to get the job done. All right, from there, we start getting into details and distinctives that make the difference in a technology decision. And on today's show, Citrix is sponsored to talk about what makes the NetScaler ADC platform distinct. This show is a follow-up to show 230 that we published back in March 2015 that kicked up one of the longer comment strings we have ever had on packetpushers.net. And so you might want to listen to that show, again, show number 230, to get an intro to NetScaler if you missed it. On today's show, we're going to address that question of differentiation. What features does the NetScaler platform have that make it unique? And this isn't just a bunch of fluffy marketing points. Rather, we decided to go into nuts and bolts of how NetScaler handles some more interesting things like layer 7 packet manipulation and policy declaration and the use of promise theory and IP fix extensions, that kind of thing. And if you don't know me, I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. I am joined by Mr. Greg Farrow as usual. And Greg, how are things?
Things are pretty good. It's been fine weather over here, and a fine weathery day here in the UK is pretty rare, to be honest. So you smile, and I had a few beers last night, which made me very happy indeed. It doesn't take much to make me happy, to be honest.
Very good. To answer the question of uniqueness, we have two folks from Citrix, the two gentlemen that were here with us on show number 230, Bino Gopal and Graham Melville. Bino, would you introduce yourself to the Packet Pushers audience?
Sure. Thanks, Ethan. Hey, everyone. My name is Bino Gopal. I'm a senior sales engineer here at Citrix NetScaler. Joined the company way back in its wee days in 2000 when we released our first product. I've been here since then, traveling all around the world, supporting the product, and now focused primarily on Southern California, and just a big fan.
Very good. And Graham, same thing. Would you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Graham Melville. I head up product management for NetScaler. Previously, I was in the wireless LAN and security space with patents on the virtualization of access points, and here now in California, despite the English accent, and the weather here too is very nice, and fortunately it's cooled down a little bit because it was 105, which is 40 degrees Celsius a couple of days ago, so very nice weather indeed.
Lovely. That's what we need. We need more of that. I love weather like that. I'm just getting comfortable.
Yeah, I think you sent us your weather, Greg, because I'm just here in LA back from the UK myself, and it's cold and foggy, so I'm not sure what's going on.
That's hella generous of me.
I don't know if I
cold and foggy in LA? I used to live in that area for a couple of years. I mean, that sounds like a San Francisco thing, not an LA thing.
Yep. It happens, though, I suppose. Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
So let's jump into some of the NetScaler differentiators, guys. And Graham, maybe you can handle this one. Let's start off with layer 7 packet manipulation. Just by way of example, let's say we're sending HTTP traffic through the NetScaler. How does the NetScaler handle that traffic? What's really going on?
So I think the primary difference when it comes to NetScaler and the whole way that NetScaler was designed was kind of a little bit what we talked about on the last one, and that is kind of our software-first design. And by having that software-first design, we needed to build something inside that would make it go as fast as ASICs, basically. And the way that we did that was rather than you having to program imperatively, we use what we call as a declarative language. So when you declare what you want to happen at layer 7, what's going to then happen then has already been pre-compiled and very highly optimized, and so you get amazing performance. But I think one of the other key advantages is because we use this kind of declarative language, it's easier to understand, and visualize. So we have some great visualization tools. So let's say you build a content switch to say, you know, how you want a URL to be sent to which server based on, you know, contents within that URL. You can visualize that very easily. You know, it just paints it as a beautiful picture on the screen, so you can see what it is, what's the rules you've written, how it's going to go, where it's going to end up. So it's much faster to implement, and because of that visualization and other things as well, it's much quicker to debug. So that's kind of one aspect, and I'm sure Binu can give us some kind of deeper dive downs there.
Let's back up just for a second here, because you got into a couple of things. I mean, one thing, you know, we kind of set up the question starting about layer 7 packet manipulation, and then we talked about how to build the policies around that as well. So you mentioned there is compiling that goes on that then leads to performance, which can therefore, so this is an x86 platform, not an ASIC-based platform.
Yeah.
And so that compilation sounds like it's a pretty key thing.
It's pre-compiled. That's the key thing. You can kind of think about it a little bit. You know, when databases first came out, you know, they're written in COBOL and Fortran, and I'm probably dating myself significantly here.
You just dated 25 years, because that's what I was studying in college.
but now you look today, you know, it's in SQL, and you compare all that you used to have to do in COBOL and Fortran. You used to have to tell the machine exactly how to do it, what steps they needed to do to get to what you wanted to do at the end. With a declarative language, you just say what you want to happen, and kind of you can think of SQL as, you know, kind of an equivalent in the database world of what to happen. And so that's the way that we work with NetScaler. So you tell it you want to use a content switch, so it brings up that code that's already been pre-compiled, and now you just give it some variables to go in there, and that's just how we end up smoking fast. You know, the more stuff you put in it, you don't get the same huge drop-off that you do with, you know, the ASIC-based controllers.
Yeah, and if I could add, guys, the key thing there with, again, the declarative policy engine is when, as an end user, right, you're building the policies, you don't have to learn any sort of, you know, sort of scripting language or something complex or complicated. And in fact, in our GUI itself, when I demo this to customers, right, when you want to do some sort of layer 7 policy, we have a drop-down, you know, box that lets you build the policy as you go. So, for example, if you want to manipulate an HTTP URL, you go to the GUI dropdown for the building the policy, and you start with HTTP, and then request a response, and then you pick URL or header, and then you, you know, add the operations like contains or exists, et cetera, and it walks you right through it. So the concept is that, and makes it simple for end users who may not necessarily be familiar with all the minutiae and details of what's going on with HTTP and, you know, the construction of all the data, to actually figure out themselves if they have some idea of what they want to do. Oh, I can actually go and had customers who, you know, didn't consider themselves expert be able to, you know, figure out layer 7, you know, rewrite rules. And that's a function of giving, you know, them the capabilities and flexibility, but still doing it in a way that makes it possible for non-experts to figure it out.
Okay, so I think what you're getting at there, so if I'm dealing with HTTP data stream, I'll have header manipulation is one of those common things that comes in. Either I want to read something that's in a header field and make a decision on it, or I need to rewrite it for whatever reason, or maybe I need to add a field to the HTTP header as that HTTP request flows through the load balancer. And it sounds like what I would do with typically in the past is I would write some kind of a script to do that with other ADC platforms that I've used. It's yep. going to be Tickle, and I'm going to build a script that's based on actions that are flowing through the load balancer. If this action happens, you know, and there's an HTTP stream that's detected, I'm going to then do this other thing. I'm going to rewrite the URI. I'm going to add a header. I'm going to do whatever it is I'm going to do, and then maybe make a load balancing decision. And I've got, again, Tickle to do that for me. And you're saying I'm not using Tickle in this case. I'm using, it doesn't sound like you described a wizard exactly, but something more along those lines that make it more straightforward to make something happen.
Exactly. Yeah, there are wizards that we do have as an option, but I was just describing the general way any policy is constructed within the NetScaler device for any and all of the different functionalities, whether, as you mentioned, you're doing things like rewrite or whether you're doing compression or caching or anything basically involving layer 7 data, right? This is from the GUI, though, we obviously have a CLI where you can go and type stuff out directly to your heart's content once you know it. But this is literally just go into a GUI, decide to add a policy, and if you're creating something from scratch, you go through that process. But one of the other things that's also there is we do have, as a function of a declarative engine, built-in expressions too. So we already have, if you look in the NetScaler when you get the box, default compression rules. And those default compression rules use built-in, expressions like, for example, the content type is text or HTML. And you can always use those as sort of springboard examples for, oh, I see, they created a policy that says, HTTP content type text HTML. And you can see from that, it's pretty simple and go off and, again, create your own expressions that you can then use in policy instruction.
Now, we've talked about HTTP. Are there other protocols that are supported here?
Oh, yeah. So we've got HTTP with, all the HTML and XML content, and then the policy engine, right, that we're talking about has been made extensible. And I guess that's a great segue into talking about one of the more recent advances and extensions we made into what we call our data stream functionality. And, that's Graham in marketing basically talking about what we do for databases with SQL traffic. So if we look at that, right, what we did is we have all of this advanced functionality on the NetScaler around what we do to optimize HTTP traffic, right? There's all these features that where we accelerate it, we offload it, we can switch it, we can health check it, we can, basically do the heck out of everything you can for HTTP. And we realize there are other, traffic protocols out there that customers have challenges with. And one of them we've heard year over year, time over time, is SQL. So we looked at that, we analyzed it, and realized that there were optimizations we can do to SQL. Some of the challenges, of course, initially were when you're dealing with SQL and databases, right, there's an issue of transaction reliability and whether or not, you're going to take responsibility for making sure the transaction's delivered. And we realized we didn't want to go that far because of, the nature of databases. So we were able to add in the data stream functionality, which looks at SQL and basically can do all the same things we do for HTTP. So if you look at, what we say about data stream, we talk about, accelerating the backend database responses. We talk about optimizing and offloading the backend databases. We talk about being able to layer 7 content switch your backend databases. And we talk about doing layer 7 intelligent health checks, right? All things that previously were not really possible because all previous iterations of load balancers out there were really just doing sort of dumb TCP type level stuff. Like they could, send some basic health check requests. They couldn't do any sort of switching. They could just see that the port was open and nothing more detailed than that. So we added true actual intelligence at the database level.
Again, you're talking about SQL specifically because, yep. I mean, the application level health checking and stuff for HTTP and some other protocols have been around for kind of a while. So you're talking about specifically, fancy stuff you're doing at the SQL with SQL specifically.
Yeah, data stream specifically, right? Mm-hmm. Just an example of your question, like we were talking about, well, you've got a policy engine here for, layer 7 for HTTP. Well, we've gone and definitely extended it to other protocols, SQL namely being one of them with the data stream technology, right? So we basically added that same exact level of intelligence, optimization, acceleration, health checking now for database, for both MySQL and MSSQL, to be clear.
Yeah, and that was just my next question because SQL means different things to different people. Yep. And what SQL are we talking about? And so it sounds like MySQL, MSSQL, those are the two supported flavors?
Exactly, because, the point is both use the underlying TDS protocol, and the concept is once you understand the TDS protocol, you're basically able to parse both of those. And so, yep, both of those are understood.
How many of those verbs, how do you track, like, the SQL is actually a moving, or it is still a living language up to, well, actually it's not very living. It doesn't change much, the word structured. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And database administrators haven't had a fresh idea in 15 years generally. But, mm-hmm. I mean, there are extensions and things. So as new language comes on, can you keep extending into the system for that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, just like with the NetScaler and mm-hmm. HTTP, and as we talk, for example, about HTTP 2.0, which is coming out, all mm-hmm. of those are basically things that, we codify into the NetScaler, and, as updates come out, we are able to do. So from the SQL perspective, once we understand a select or a read or, all the various different SQL commands and program those in on the NetScaler, if any changes, as slow as they may be, as you pointed out, Greg, right, come, then, we're able to add those in as needed.
Yeah, and imagine you could do the same thing. So if you're decoding the SQL stream and then you're able to take action, so you say, if I see this SQL command, then do this. If you're selecting this database, send you to this server. Is that the sort of idea?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to give three clear, specific examples, the SQL side in terms of what we're doing to improve databases, the first specific thing we talked about with optimization right on data stream, we call it scale up. So it's SQL multiplexing. So the concept is the exact same thing we do for HTTP, where the NetScaler acts as a TCP proxy, and we multiplex incoming client connections into fewer server-side connections, so i.e. connection offload.
Yep.
So we actually have fewer TCP connections going to your backend SQL databases, which, as it turns out, is a more beneficial feature than even the regular HTTP offload, because the amount of resources a SQL connection, TCP connection, takes up is far more on a SQL server than, on a regular HTTP server with a regular TCP connection. And that, we've seen in testing, has shown up to a 30-to-1 TCP connection offload, which frees up the SQL databases to just process transactions and not deal with TCP connection overhead.
It's similar sort of thing with web servers, yeah.
If you look at one of our early customers on this, they're actually a UK customer, about 365. And, on each of their servers, they were down from 2,000 to 100 connections. So it's, really significant. Their system was busting at the seams. I mean, on a heavy sports weekend, they're literally dealing with millions of transactions.
Yeah, it really does make an extraordinary difference too. Also on the web servers themselves, because they're not holding open massive and not allocating memory to buffers for the TCP. So it works both ways, not only on a SQL server, but on the web servers themselves, because they have to open TCP sessions. And when they attach to the SQL server, they try and mux 20 or 30 TCP sockets so that they can increase the take up. That's correct.
Yep, exactly. Yep. And as I mentioned, it's more of a benefit on the SQL servers because each TCP connection uses correspondingly more resources. And as Graham pointed out, usually what we see more of is customers complaining about SQL databases not being able to keep up with the load over the years when we told them about, HTTP offload. So finally, now we've got the technology that, a lot of customers have been wanting on that perspective. And to answer your other question with, what we do with the traffic, another thing is the scale out on data stream, which is natively, as I mentioned, understanding the SQL and switching it. So one of the key benefits you can do is split up your SQL databases into a read cluster and a write cluster. So you can actually have incoming select statements come in, sent to a smaller, cluster for read, so that, longer, processing writes are not being, having selects queued up behind them. So instead, you have them split up and the databases are more optimized for the function that they can do, and you get better response and, scalability from the databases.
Yeah, because if you always send the same reads to the same server, because we're looking deep into the SQL stream, if you send the same reads to the same server, also the buffers within the server are going to be holding the latest data. So the actual response times go up significantly as well.
Mm. Now, it's not just SQL too, right? There's several protocols that you would recognize, like FTP, Radius, that type of thing?
Yep. Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I mean, if you look at the NetScaler right now, we have built-in knowledge and understanding for lots of different protocols. So on the NetScaler, in the GUI, or on the CLI, if you add a service or service group, which is the basic fundamental object we manipulate, right? The way it works, and this actually goes back to what you guys were talking about initially, I think, Ethan, with sort of like the code and the optimization, and we went on to the declarative policy engine. What happens with the NetScaler is we basically have different code paths that go through the NetScaler stack. Remember, we have this custom TCP stack we developed from the ground up. We call it a packet engine, right? That was written by engineers back in 1998, and they wrote from scratch this, you know, completely, you know, optimized TCP proxy offload kernel. And the way it works is different types of traffic take different code paths through the NetScaler. So if you're a generic TCP packet, you go through a different code path that has different capabilities available to you. For example, it doesn't go through any of the layer 7 branches because it has no need to. It's generic TCP, right? Like, and if you look at HTTP though, right, HTTP goes through a whole different code path because it has to have caching functionality, rewrite functionality, content filtering, all that stuff available to it. But at the same time, you know, there's definitely TCP offload, et cetera. But since then, what we've done is, as you pointed out, right, so you can add a service type as HTTP, you can add a service type as TCP, but then there's all sorts of different ports and protocols that do different things. For example, you know, there's a whole UDP separate engine that we actually developed. Not a lot of people may know this because I've been around since the beginning, but, you know, we didn't actually have UDP support way back in the beginning because it's a whole different animal. It's a connectionless protocol, right? Yeah. So we actually had to add an UDP engine to handle UDP traffic and DNS and therefore things like Radius and add in support for each and every one of those ports and protocols as we went along. So if you look, and when you add that service type, at this point, there's a whole list of like 20 plus different things where the NetScaler can add something as you pointed out, FTP or Radius or DNS or UDP or, you know, all the different ports and protocols that one can really think of. And we keep adding more and more as time goes on.
I mean, your architecture, if I remember rightly, the hardware acceleration occurs in the network interface, not actually inside of the CPU silicon or the custom silicon. It's just the network adapter.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say there's necessarily acceleration per se in the network adapter. The key thing is that basically the architecture is such that because we don't have, you know, the host OS, right, involved in any of the data flow, right? When you on the NetScaler, when a packet comes in off the wire, it goes straight from the NIC into the NetScaler packet engine kernel, right? And so at that point, you have no limitation of that, you know, existing host OS. So it can go through the code path that it needs to, get processed as fast as possible, go back out, and therefore, you know, you're not introducing any latency. And it's, you know, a polling architecture that's not interrupt driven and all sorts of other, you know, fancy optimizations that our, you know, wizard engineers have done. So it allows you to, as Graham was kind of pointing out, do things natively, right? That's a big key differentiator on the NetScaler. We do things natively, for example, at layer 7. We don't have a separate mode that you have to turn on or a button or a switch or anything to check to do TCP proxy, to do layer 7 processing, right, at that point. So we don't suffer performance degradations when we're doing all of this, you know, layer 7 processing, which is what a lot of customers want to do more and more of. And that is a big differentiator. We don't publish separate numbers, to be clear, right? Like saying that, oh, this is our layer 7 performance, it drops. When we give you HTTP requests per second, that's doing layer 7 content switching or any of that stuff.
So you're not saying, you know, we're just doing HTTP load balancing at layer 4, we do this much, and at layer 7, it depends.
Yep, correct.
You can't. You're saying that you can give me a guarantee during the sales process that this box will perform at this speed no matter what I do to the HTTP. You know, what merging analysis.
And the great thing about that, to be real clear, is back in 2009, part of that was when we went multi-core with the MPX line. Right. Back in the day when we were single core with a Intel architecture, we were CPU limited, such that to that exact point, I always got this all the time. We're like, you have a box that says it can do 1 gig of throughput. But what's the real world performance when I turn on content switching and compression and web app firewall and all the other stuff? And I'm like, yeah, I know it depends. Now that we've got, you know, boxes with 6, 7, 11, 16 cores, at this point, we use 2-3 cores for all the packet processing. And then you have all these additional cores available for performance. So you can turn on all the layer 7 functionality you want from compression, app firewall, et cetera, so that we can say if this box says it's going to do X gigs or this box says this many requests per second, we're not robbing Peter to pay Paul to get that kind of traffic.
But right? That's important because often you buy these boxes without a good understanding of what your traffic, like when you go to the developers and say, you know, well, how big does my load balancer need to be? And they go, well, you know, we think we'll have 5,000 users. And you go like, what does that turn into connections per second? They go, I don't know. And what is it in megabits per second? I don't know. We don't know. We haven't tested that, you know, and we've got no way of testing it.
It worked fine on the LAN, though.
Yeah, it works fine when I put it on my desk. I mean, I guess there's a couple of sequential things to this as well is, you know, if you know exactly how the performance is going to go, that makes it – or that gives you a sense of what you're getting for the money in that sense. But I think also because you've got a software architecture, you're not dependent on hardware. So your MPX is still, you know, not there's no magic inside the box there.
Yeah, actually, it's really funny you say that, because something interesting that happened is when in 2009, I remember this, you know, like I've been with the company for a while. I've been in the field. I got a lot of coworkers who've been there for a while. And when they introduced the MPX, they also mentioned the VPX, the virtual NetScaler, right? And I remember thinking at the time and looking around my coworkers, we had conversations about this, like, what is that? Why would we ever use a virtual appliance? Performance is going to suck and it's not going to be good and no, right? Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I've come around 180 degrees, and that was a great decision, because in the end, you know, the secret sauce is in the software, as, you know, Graham basically, you know, mentioned earlier, right? It's all about that NetScaler code, and we lifted that code off the MPX hardware platform, put into a virtual, you know, instance, the VPX that runs on, you know, KVM, Xen, Hyper-V, or, you know, VMware, all of the standard hypervisors, and it performs just as well, you know, with hypervisor limitations, of course, and the fact that with a VPX, there's no hardware SSL offload, except for some AES functionality now on certain Intel chips, which isn't that widespread. So for the most part, we say you don't get any of the SSL offload. But literally, other than that, like, you know, the NetScaler code is there rocking it and basically doing all it can.
Which is different. You know. Well, it's different. Like, I'm just going to speak to some of your competitors here. So A10 is a pure software implementation. They have a particular software architecture, and we've talked to them. But F5 can't bring their code base from their existing because it's hardware dependent. Yep. And they had to go and buy another company called LineRate, which is now their virtual product. And so the hardware product runs on a completely different code base to their virtual product. And the two, if you – there's potential there for implementation or software bugs to happen in one that doesn't happen in the other, or for things to operate differently on the two platforms. I'm sure F5 doesn't intend that, but that's the gap, whereas you're running exactly the same code in the virtual as you are in the physical appliances.
And, yeah, to be 100% clear, when you log on to a NetScaler VPX and you log on to an MPX, you're presented with the same GUI, the same CLI. When you want to upgrade your VPX, you download build 10.1, you know, 55.3, and you use that same exact tarball to upgrade your MPX hardware to the latest build. So we're the same code base, have been since day one, and will continue to be till, you know, whenever, because that's how it's architected.
And that's a comfort to me. Like, so from my point of view, I know I'm running the same code everywhere. I can expect it to perform the same. Whereas if I'm running one code base for virtual and another one for physical, I've always got this thing in the back of my throat, like, is it gonna, you know, as an architect anyway, it's just a concern. It's part of your buying decision.
You have to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and, you know, all sorts of caveats, which honestly you'd rather not have to deal with. You just rather things work the same, right? And Graham, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and it's not even that simple, because, you know, on their hardware platforms, they also have different paths. So, you know, for example, if you want to do basic load balancing, you can kind of, you know, L4 load balancing, you can hit the numbers on the data sheet. But, you know, you want to do IPv6, oh, well, now you can't use the ASICs. You want to do internet facing traffic? Oh, now you can't use the ASICs. In fact, if you look through their, you know, if you look through their guidelines, there's pretty much nothing you can actually use the ASICs for in the real world. And so, you know, you're being quoted a 10 gig platform, and the reality is you're going to be lucky to get, you know, 100 megs out of it.
I think that's why Cisco went away from the ACE module. So those of us who bought their application control engine and the load balancer there, it was, you know, it could do, you know, gigabits. As long as you were only doing TCP and UDP load balancing, simple stuff. But when you went up to application inspection, it cranked right the way back to under 400 megabits per second instead of 4 gigabits per second. And that was if you're using it as security appliance, that's like not right at all. And that was because of the ASIC. You know, there was three data paths through the box. And if you're in the simple data path, it went straight through an ASIC core. And if it went through a secondary data path, it went through a slightly different processor, which was, you know, slower. And then there was a processor part or straight up to the CPU, and it would run at hundreds of megabits per second if you were lucky, if it didn't actually just die and stop working, which is my experience quite often, you know.
Yeah, I mean that's exactly it. I mean, people forget there's an evil twin to FastPath. If you see something that says FastPath, you know, alarm bells should go off. It's like, okay,
Yes.
So that means there's a slow part.
Exactly.
Yep. So we've established that you can do load balancing based on what I call verbs. So inside of a protocol, there's actually language inside of there. So HTTP, it's get and it's put and set cookie, what cookie. And inside of the NetScaler, there are things you do in load balancers where you say load balance on by URL, load balance, you know, maybe you get the load balancer to set a cookie for some reason. I know there are reasons as to why you want to do that. Like if the website comes in, you get the load balancer to set a cookie to say at least you got to the front end. And then the back end can query that to see where you came in. It can validate you're coming via the right path. But it's probably time that we moved on and started talking about the AppFlow features and how the Layer 2 extensions integrate with IPFix.
Yeah, sure. So AppFlow is a really cool sort of greenfield technology that we developed, guys. So the concept was one of the things that we've been hearing from customers since the beginning of time is always, help me troubleshoot what's going on with my devices and in my network. Right. And one of the ways that network administrators do that nowadays is with, you know, NetFlow technology and, you know, devices that basically parse NetFlow data for visibility. And, you know, that uses the underlying IPFix protocol. And the concept is every network administrator basically has something from SolarWinds or, you know, HP OpenView or Splunk or something that basically collects the NetFlow data from all their network devices, which looks at basically TCP flows, source IP port to dest IP port, right?
And that data is varies depending on what NetFlow version you're running. It varies depending on whether it's sampled NetFlow data or not, but it's a standard format so you can figure out what's actually going through the pipe, and then it can aggregate those statistics and give you some pretty reporting and do some graphs. And this is the application that was going through this interface at this time, so you get historical trending. And like you said, SolarWinds and a variety of other platforms are NetFlow collectors that'll aggregate and present that data for you.
But when you look at it, in the end of the day, it's TCP flow data, right? So it's not necessarily the most sort of informative. And what we realized, And what we realized is customers want application level reporting and data. So from a troubleshooting perspective, that provides them with the kind of information they really need. And we realized that we had an opportunity to do that with the NetScaler. So what we did is we took the IPFix protocol. And we added completely open source extensions to it. And, you know, it's easier with a visual, but, you know, this is something you can always go look up on our website, right? The AppFlow extensions we added, IPFix is a text-based protocol. So all we did is just added a whole bunch of text fields. Like, for example, we added things like transaction ID to track flows, TCP timing data for each transaction and classify the flows by name, and then added a whole bunch of layer 7 extensions. So, for example, one of the fields is HTTP request URL or HTTP request method or user agent, request size, response size, server latency, server response time. We added all of these fields into the packets that were being sent so that, you know, now you've taken IPFix and extended it beyond NetFlow to what we're calling AppFlow because we've added all this layer 7 information. And the concept is just like you said, Ethan, right? Now you are able to send this data to collectors that basically can take it. And if they can understand the additional fields, which is not that hard to do since, again, it's just text fields, they can generate nice reports and pretty charts, but actually so application level data. So you can actually have things like what's the response time for OWA or SharePoint? And when did the first byte come in? When did the last byte go in? What percentage of my traffic is it? What are my top URLs? Who are the top users?
You could get into transactional information more accurately now with that layer 7 data extended. Because if it's TCP, you can infer with some degree of accuracy what the application is, but you don't know. I mean, you're not looking deep inside and actually understanding what the application truly is. So now, if you're baking layer 7 extensions into that IPFix data, you've got not only the TCP flow data, but you've also got what is this application actually riding across these ports and what's really happening. And then you can build much more interesting and rich set of data and reporting so you know what's really going on.
Yeah, and for example, anyone who's running applications and doing troubleshooting, one of the holy grails, for example, like on a web page from a download perspective is the waterfall chart with the, you know, response breakdown, you know, for a URL page. So it goes from, you know, how much time it takes to load the page, render the page, time to first byte, processing time, time to last byte, overall response time, broken down for all the embedded objects. You have that data now going through the NetScaler. Now, the interesting thing is the concept originally was, well, we have customers who already have all of these different reporting tools that they're already using in their network, and we didn't want to necessarily add another one, right? And we thought, let's integrate with Splunk and OpenView and SolarWinds and all these guys. So initially, our approach was, okay, let's contact these vendors, tell them about AppFlow, how great it is, customers want it, and have them offer a plugin or an update that could parse, you know, the AppFlow data so that customers can use their existing tools and get all this reporting. Problem is, despite the initial enthusiastic response, the follow-through didn't quite, you know, keep up, right? As I'm sure you guys probably would have expected. So, we had vendors who said they'd come out with a plugin, and then 6 months later, we're like, where is it? And they're like, oh, that guy left, and we haven't tasked anyone with, you know, doing it. And we're like, okay. So customers were not getting the value, so we realized we had to come out with our own solution, right? So we came out with something called NetScaler Insight Center, right? And you can download that off the website, free download on any addition to NetScaler, and we have two solutions, Web Insight and HDX Insight. And the concept is, you know, as you can probably guess, the Web Insight reports on HTTP web traffic, and the HDX Insight reports on all of your HDX ICA traffic, which, you know, is huge for ICA and Citrix customers because they haven't really had that level of detail at the network level for what's going on.
Just to interrupt you here, the Insight Center tool is specifically for NetScaler IPFix data. I couldn't just download it as a free tool and throw NetFlow data at it and get something out of it?
No, it's specifically for the AppFlow, right, which is the IPFix enhanced version. So that's
specifically you wrote it for AppFlow data. Yep. Okay. And so I've got to have AppFlow, which at this point is coming off of my NetScalers to feed into this thing to get something useful out of it. Got it. Okay. Yep.
Exactly. And the key thing on the NetScaler, too, is the way that the AppFlow works is you decide what you want to report on, for example. You don't have to enable AppFlow reporting for everything on every virtual server, which is the basic fundamental object, you know, you send traffic to. You can check the little box that says AppFlow logging. And when you have your AppFlow collector, i.e. Insight Center, installed, we basically send the data to, you know, that, and then it gets all the data to collect and report.
Is there a reason I wouldn't want to check the box for AppFlow everywhere?
Sometimes, you know, if it's high enough load, as you can probably guess, having AppFlow reporting does add a little overhead, something in the order of 10% or so, you know, in terms of CPU. Most normal customers, you would never have a problem, but just because we wanted to give people the ability to control it, you know, you do have the capability to, you know, turn it on or not. For example, say you've got a big website and you're running just like a HTTP website traffic to a generic site that you don't really care about, but then there's something where a shopping cart where you do care about what's happening with latency, so you can, you know, not have AppFlow on for like the regular dumb dub dub dub, but make sure it's enabled for all the SSL payment transaction, you know, side of things or more valuable, you know, parts of the site. So it at least gives you control to have that.
Because there is, again, there is some amount of CPU impact. You said about 10% because it's got to look at the data stream. It's got to pull the interesting information out to form the IPFix record. And then it's got to ship it off to the collector, and all of that takes a little bit.
Yeah, well, you got memory buffers you got to store and packets you got to look at. It's processing that's involved. So, yeah, there is a little bit of the overhead that you have to consider. Yep.
So the Insight Center tool, then I load up as a VM. Sitting off to the side?
Yep, correct. Pretty cool that, you know, and obviously no issues with it being updated or being compatible or understanding the latest, you know, AppFlow fields and records.
And then do I just throw a bunch of storage at it so that I can retain historical data if I want?
Yeah, that is one thing. And actually, you know, from a customer's perspective, this is actually an interesting point I'll make for readers who may be interested, right? So from a NetScaler perspective, you know, we have a whole bunch of features and functionality, right? From load balancing, content switching, GSLB, web app firewall. And the way we package it to try and make it simple for customers is we have different editions, standard edition, enterprise edition, platinum edition, right? Just those three basic ones. And the concept is a lot of Citrix customers in the past, right, were only using NetScaler for remote access with our, you know, remote access SSL VPN, our access gateway, now NetScaler gateway technology, and haven't really needed the, you know, standard enterprise or platinum editions. Well, what happens with AppFlow, because of the features it's leveraging and the kind of detailed reporting that you can now get out of it, if you want real-time AppFlow data, you need at least the enterprise edition. And if you want historical data, you need the platinum edition. So it's been good from our perspective for customers to be able to leverage more features and functionality so that they get into, you know, a more advanced NetScaler basically. And then they can actually start looking at, you know, oh, we can load balance this and we can compress that and accelerate things and offload things and do GSLB and even, you know, turn on web app firewall features to protect the site, et cetera, et cetera. So you do need either Enterprise or Platinum to get real-time or historical app flow reporting.
Yeah, I'm just looking on your website here about the – you've got some use cases in the product demonstration talking about Web Insight, and you're actually charting things like the data center latency versus the internet side latency and then showing the response time for host delay, so how long it takes, which is pretty useful in terms of proving it's not the network.
Yeah, it's incredibly useful. I mean, it's useful for when you got the website up and running to see exactly where the issue is. I mean, interestingly, after we released this tool at executive briefing centers, I started asking the networking team, if the app team phones you up and says, is there a problem with the network? What do you do? And 95%, we just say no. A few said, well, I put them on hold for a bit so it makes it look like I'm doing something. Then I say no. And it's like, why? Yeah. And they're like, because it's a stupid question. Of course there's a problem with the network somewhere. We're operating these huge networks, you know. Yeah. There's always something somewhere. If they can't give us any detail at all, I mean, what do they expect us to do?
Right. Yeah.
Whereas when you're using this tool and you phone up and you say, hey, I don't really understand this stuff, but my monitor is showing that my round trip delay out to branch XYZ is, 900 milliseconds. And it says usually that should be 23. Do you think there's a problem in the network? Yeah. Now they can say, oh, yeah, that doesn't sound right. Let me take a look. Yes. As opposed to, well, I got a user with a problem. I'm wondering if it's the network. Is there a problem?
Those questions. I know. Oh, stupid question. Absolutely. But people don't know to ask anything. I had a script I used to go through just to qualify the question. I'd sigh inwardly, throw up a little bit, and then go, okay. When this problem comes up, and then, you know, off you go.
Yeah. So we're not replacing network management tools or, you know, detailed analysis tools. What we're doing is giving a very high level, very fast fix to where the issue is. The other interesting thing is, I mean, we just won a bake-off at a customer with a large website that was moving a lot of its internal apps onto web apps, et cetera, and, you know, so we went through and, you know, basically the performance and the kind of declarative and software design that we've been talking about proved itself. We were way faster than the competition. But when they saw Web Insight, they're like, if we'd known that this existed 18 months ago, we'd have bought you right then. You would have saved us so much time on our web development if we could have seen this kind of stuff as we were developing our web apps. So, you know, it's actually useful in development too, to be able to see, you know, exactly where the hang-ups are, where the hold-ups are. And, you know, particularly if you're an e-commerce site, you know, they talk about a 4-second abandonment rate, but most of us are like, 4 seconds? I'd never wait that long. So if you've got...
They're talking now about a 500 millisecond abandonment rate on mobile.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So if you've got stuff that's sticking, you need to know where it is real fast, exactly, you know, particularly if you're going through some complex content switching that's, you know, pages are dynamic. It's not coming from one place. So, you know, what's the hold up? What was stopping it working? To be able to get to that very quickly without having to go and suck all the data off each individual server and switch and what have you is enormous value to our, you know, big dot coms.
So I wanted to go back to kind of what we started talking about where we were getting into the declarative engine. And it reminded me of something that I wanted to bring up and get your guys' take on it. When you talk about declarative language, we start talking about intent, which is a big topic in software-defined networking, right?
Yeah.
If I want to make something happen in my software-defined network, how do I tell the network what it is I want to do? And then the software interprets that request and then makes the magic happen under the hood. I mean, you guys have a declarative engine here. Does that give you an advantage on the SDN side?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I've just come back from Cisco Live, so it's kind of top of mind. You know, if you look at the way we're integrated into the ACI and policy engine, you can control everything in the NetScaler from ACI. You don't have to touch the NetScaler at all. And that's because of that declarative language. It's very, very easy to integrate through our Nitro interfaces into, you know, all sorts of things.
Just to level set here, when you're talking about Cisco ACI, we're talking about the APIC controller with the Nexus 9000 switches on the back end and integrating NetScaler into that environment for purposes of service chaining, let's say. So you've got it as part of the, if I remember the terminology right, the endpoint groups, NetScaler is put in there as part of the traffic path between a couple of endpoints. And yes, that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, well, now a lot of people can do that. So I can take pretty much any ADC or firewall or, you know, the whole ecosystem in Cisco here right now is very, very open. So, you know, they've got their competitors like F5 and Checkpoint and Palo Alto Network, as well as, you know, their strategic partners like Citrix in the same mix. But the difference is, you know, you want to put, for example, some other ADC in there. You need to configure the ADC and then bring it in. So you're still doing everything you did before, plus now you get to, you know, put it in the chain, etc. And, you know, the promise of SDM was that it made it simpler. So, you know, by anything plus anything is more.
Yeah.
You know, assuming we're working right. In positive numbers, which we are here. So just because it's now easier to put it in the service chain doesn't make it simpler. If you still have to, you know, write all that scripting and write all those rules, you know, in the same way as you did before. So I think this is where our declarative language comes in. And if you look at some of the work, you know, that we've done with the likes of Microsoft, IBM, SunGuard, and of course Cisco around things like, you know, OpFlex, it needs a declarative approach. You know, that part of the starting place and the premise for that was SDN is never going to scale if it's going to work off an imperative model. I mean, it's just not going to scale. It's not going to work in the big network.
And again, declarative versus imperative. Declarative, what you want to do, versus imperative, how to do what you want to do.
Exactly, yeah.
So the idea here with the declarative language is I need to accomplish some high-level task, but I don't want to have to worry about the nitty-gritty details of how it's actually getting done.
Exactly.
So if I can express it at a high level, then I don't have to worry about what's going on at the lower level, and it doesn't even matter what device is getting that job done for me.
Yep.
In this case, we're talking about NetScaler specifically. So you're saying the declarative language already exists, and the NetScaler gets that job done however it does it, and we don't care at that low level because it's at the high level where we're worried about it, expressing an intent, declaring what it is we want to do.
Like you said, the term declarative basically tells you what's going on. And the concept basically is we want to abstract all the underlying policy framework infrastructure, including the object model, APIs, the language syntax, away from the administrators. So that way they're basically freed up to focus on, you know, optimizing straightforward application delivery policies. Like, I just want to compress this, I want to cache that, so that they can focus on, you know, other things rather than learning, okay, I need to code this exact way to make it, oh, wait, no, that didn't work. Oh, wait, how do I get support on? Oh, wait, that's not supported. So, I mean, you know, we took a very different approach to, you know, doing that. And that was the whole concept behind it. And it runs faster, too, right? That's the whole point, like the built-in policies and the way that we process that stuff. It also runs faster, which is why we can operate natively at layer 7, right? And don't have to have a separate layer 4 mode. And like you said, with SDN, what we're doing with the NetScaler from an SDN perspective is, you know, we talked about the SDX platform, right? You know, the last podcast where we have the NetScaler that's basically been virtualized, right? I want to make sure we went over this again real quick, has the capability to run multiple VPX instances. But beyond just the multiple VPX instances, right, we've actually extended it so that we can actually have third-party VM instances running on the NetScaler. So, for example, you know, we have BlueCat or WebSense or CSE has, you know, instances of their what were normally hardware devices or even virtual instances that can run on a NetScaler SDX platform. And Palo Alto, right, one of the leading network firewall vendors, right, they mm-hmm. have a VM series that can be run on the NetScaler SDX. So the whole concept now is you have this virtualized network services platform, right, that's basically a service delivery device that gets installed into the network. And as we talk about these, you know, future SDN type deployments, the key thing that's happening is the orchestration of these devices. Because the whole point is, in an SDN type environment, you don't really want to deal with the underlying nitty-gritty. Like Graham was saying, you just want to get stuff done. So we have the capability with orchestration, right? That's part of the NetScale solution, i.e. cloud platform, you know, which is cloud stack, where it can talk to not just us, but the other components either on the SDX or in the network itself using, you know, APIs as needed, and basically do things literally like from the ground up. We have demos that show you spinning up a whole new set of servers, configuring them, adding them into the NetScaler load balancing pool, configuring firewalls or other rules on other devices or other, you know, VMs on the SDX as load increases, right? And then as load decreases, going through the whole reverse process and basically bringing those down so that you can basically deliver on-demand services as needed as traffic grows or changes or shrinks. And that's the promise of SDN. That's where, you know, customers basically do want to go. It's just that other vendors aren't enabling it the same way because of the type of architecture and design they have, whereas with our architecture and approach, we enable that in a much simpler fashion for customers to be able to do.
You have an advantage there because you've been doing it this way for a long time. And now with the SDN model, a lot of the rest of the industry is coming around to saying, okay, we probably need to move to a declarative model. That there's some arguments about what declarative means and how specific we want to get when we say declarative. Do I say I want a virtual network or do I say I want a VLAN? Where do you draw the line as far as specificity? I know that's another big discussion. But you got a point here with your declarative language. You're really set up for that wherever that goes. And interestingly, it makes it easier for people to integrate with your platform, but it does put a burden on Citrix to maintain that abstraction level between the declarative language on top and the actual imperatives of what's happening underneath. You guys got to keep up with that and provide a window into your world that people can continue to work with without it changing every time you upgrade software.
And it does, and the underlying part there is our RESTful APIs, and so, you know, whether it's OpenStack or ACI or our own, you know, cloud platform, all of that is done through these RESTful APIs. It's very, very easy to interface and control the NetScaler from any control module outside.
Mm. Yeah, that Nitro API that we've been talking about and mentioning that basically gets used either by administrators, right? We have customers who basically never log into the NetScaler GUI or the CLI. They've actually developed custom interfaces using that Nitro API. That Nitro API is the RESTful API that gets used by not just, you know, cloud platform, cloud stack, but OpenStack or any other sort of orchestration solution out there, right? Basically, you can call that API interface. And actually, one thing to mention, since we're just talking about orchestration and SDN, one other thing we've done from an abstraction perspective to make it easier, actually, is we introduced something called NetScaler Control Center. So the concept is if you have multiple different orchestration solutions out there from CloudStack, OpenStack, VMware, NSX, et cetera, and they need to talk to the NetScaler, what happens when we update the NetScaler? The orchestration solutions would need to get updated. They may not keep that up. You know, things may break. So as part of our, you know, future focus on SDN, we developed NetScale Control Center as an intermediary layer. So basically, we just expose Control Center to the orchestration solutions, and Control Center presents the same interface that doesn't change. And then on the back end, when you update the NetScaler code, right, it talks to Control Center, and Control Center gets updated to talk to us, so you never have a breakage, right? So you never have an instance where all of a sudden all of your orchestration policies basically break because you just updated the software on your NetScaler and, you know, the orchestration solution wasn't up to date.
Well, guys, this has been a pretty interesting conversation. It was useful as far as talking about real differentiators and things that make the platform different and got into some pretty interesting directions, and that was good. Graham, where can people go if they want to dig into NetScaler more?
Best place to go is netscaler.com. That'll take you straight to the landing page on Citrix for NetScaler, and you can then kind of dive into the tech info and other tabs and see all about it.
Perfect. And then, Graham, how can people follow you on the internet?
So Twitter handle is gmelville80, and you can also find me on LinkedIn.
Oh, perfect. Bino, same question.
Sure. If you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter. I've got a sort of nom de guerre back when, you know, you weren't supposed to use your real name. I got online with the username Keltrain, KELTRAINE, and I just happen to use it everywhere. So that's how you can follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn and, well, everything else pretty much.
Very good. And so you guys can that are listening to the show can follow them that way and tweet questions at them if you need. And also, I'm sure you guys will do like you did last time. If you have comments about this show or questions for Citrix, leave a comment on the blog post on packetpushers.net that will accompany this show, and they'll get back with you. They were interacting with a number of people that commented last time and exchanging information. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. Greg Farrow is at Ethereal Mind, and EtherealMind.com is his blog. And this has been the Packet Pushers Weekly Podcast. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, and just generally spread the love. We really appreciate it. If you have any questions or comments about this show or anything else on your mind, please send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. And finally, remember that too much networking would never be enough.